Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
What's it really like to be a medical examiner? Sometimes they call him a coroner. There must be some difference, but I don't think I know. Anyway, my guest performed autopsies on victims of the 9/11 terrorist attack. She's been forensic consultant on high-profile legal cases, as well as less-profile legal cases, and also for the TV shows ER and Mythbusters. Would you believe Warner Brothers has optioned her book for a television series? So she's hot stuff. It would be kind of an odd term to describe somebody who's involved in very cold cases. She is the author of Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 bodies, and the making of a medical examiner. Dr. Judy Melnick, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks for inviting me. I love the show.
Good. Thanks. Wow. It's very important to pander to the host. It's rule number one of guesting. You know, I talked about TV shows briefly, the CSI, there's Law and Order. What is not accurate in the way in which medical examiners are portrayed on shows like that?
Primarily, they don't get the science right when it comes to how we actually do the job. So for one thing, when you're performing an autopsy, you have to protect yourself. You need a face mask, you need a shield, you need gear. I have a Tyvek suit sometimes, and none of that is shown on television. They're walking around in their street clothes and they're cutting up dead bodies without any personal protective gear. Additionally, they're walking around in high-heeled shoes, which if I get called out to a crime scene at 2 o'clock in the morning, I don't know where it's going to be. It might be on a slope where a body's been dumped. It could be down by the marina where there's uneven slats. I'm wearing sensible shoes and a warm jacket. And then also with regards to the television shows, they always have the pathologist in some sort of intramural romance with a police officer or a prosecutor. And just like any other job, on-the-job romances are frowned upon and you can end up losing your job, all the more so for a forensic pathologist where you have to be unbiased in your assessment of the findings.
Actually, that it's somewhat reassuring. It's not that they got really the science wrong. They've taken reasonable license in order to make things entertaining, a little high-heeled shoes, a little romance. You know, obviously, having you in a Tyvek suit can get a little boring, and a lot of people watch TV because they are interested in the costumes as much as so. But I feel that's okay. But in reality, what would surprise me, or what surprised you, when you first became a medical examiner, was there anything that surprised you about what it's actually like?
The first thing that surprised me was that I was expected to go out to crime scenes. I thought that I would be doing autopsies, and I didn't realize that a large part of the job was going out to a scene, because you can't just interpret the physical findings in a vacuum. You need to know where the body was found, what position. That helps you interpret your findings in the autopsy suite. And the other thing I didn't know about was how involved I would end up being in communicating with family members. I thought that I would just do the autopsy and write a report, maybe talk to a police officer. But in reality, families need closure and they want answers. And oftentimes the police and even the investigators at the office can't give it to them. They need to speak to the doctor.
How often really is the context critical to identifying cause of death? I mean,
it's more important in traumatic deaths. So if a person collapses from a natural disease, I can usually figure that out on the body. But if you have someone who has burst blood vessels in their eyes and they're found wedged in a particular location at the scene, you could mistake that for a homicide if you didn't know the position of the body and how it was found.
Okay. And in terms of you said if it's a normal cause of death, I would imagine the large percentage of your cases, there is at least a presumption that it isn't natural causes. Is that correct? How often do you really get these normal, just natural causes deaths?
The preponderance of what we see are natural diseases or accidents, things like overdoses, drug abuse, things like that. The homicides are about 10% of what a medical examiner Examiner investigates. Again, that's disproportionate to what you see on television. On television, it's always the homicides.
Right. Why would you be, you know, my mom died fairly recently, and there would be no need for an autopsy. It was her time. She died. Why would, you know, obviously except in cases of overdose or whatever, under what circumstances would you be doing an autopsy over for a person who's died of very, very likely natural causes?
The cases where we do autopsies and the findings are natural are cases where people die unexpectedly from the natural disease just going about their daily business. So they may be found on the street, or they might be found in their apartment and they've been locked in there for sometimes even months until the body is found. Mm-hmm. And then there's questions about their medical history, either because they're not identified or because they're identified, but because of the delay in finding them, people have questions about the death and want to have certainty for the family, for instance, to make sure there was no foul play.
Does the family have a right to request an autopsy at public expense?
The family does have a right to request an autopsy. It may not be honored. In many cases, if they have any suspicion that there's foul play, it needs to be communicated to the medical examiner or coroner, and that's going to factor into the decision of whether or not an autopsy is going to be done. So if a family has any suspicion, it's better off to communicate that with the coroner or the medical examiner and have it done on public expense than to pay for a second autopsy out of your own pocket, where that those findings may not be honored in terms of what's on the death certificate. So you're actually better off communicating with the people who do the investigation.
Yeah, so I notice you're doing the same thing I did with using the term medical examiner and coroner. What really is the difference?
That's a great question. A lot of people don't understand the difference. A medical examiner is a forensic pathologist, is a doctor who's board certified in this specialty field, who runs a death investigation system or office. A coroner is often a law enforcement officer or an administrator who's charged with running the office, but they don't do the autopsies.
Okay.
So they'll run the paperwork. They can order an autopsy, but they still have to hire forensic pathologists to do the autopsies. So it's still going to be a doctor who's doing the autopsy. It's just how the paperwork and how the money is managed.
Got a really, really clear difference. Okay, you talked about the fact that you often have to deal with the grieving persons. Give me a memorable, but not just an outlier, a memorable example of what that is like.
Well, one of the cases I discuss in Working Stiff is a case where a guy is found dumped in a postal bin. He is starting to decompose. He was a known drug user, but he had never used heroin in the past. And in communicating with his sister, I found out that he was actually afraid of needles and was not a regular user of heroin. Because of that information, that was passed on to the police, and our investigation progressed until we found out from police interrogation that he had been injected by another person. His sister insisted he would never inject himself. Mm-hmm. He's afraid of needles. Mm-hmm. And because of that finding, the case was then classified as a homicide. So that would not have progressed if we didn't get that crucial information from the family.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko, my guest who, by the way, Judy, you said this is your fourth interview. You're great.
You
are so articulate and concise and interesting. You're going to go far, kiddo. Anyway, I'm talking with Dr. Judy Melnick. She is a medical examiner, forensic pathologist, consulting person, and her book is with the best title in the world for this would be Working Stiff, not would be, is Working Stiff, subtitle, 2 years, 262 bodies, and the making of a medical examiner. Walk me through a typical case. Now, I was like a typical idiot who I thought that you first saw the patient when they came with a body bag and a tote tag. But you said he often starts out out in the field. This time, instead of an outlier, an aberration, talk to me about the prototypical case from the first nanosecond you're informed that you got one.
So the office gets called anytime someone dies suddenly or unexpectedly. And that could be at their house where the body is found by family member or a friend. It could be when they collapse on the street and they may die right there, or they could be brought to the hospital and the doctors in the emergency room pronounce them dead but don't know why they died. So those calls can come in either from the 911 from dispatch. They can come from the hospital, from a nurse or a doctor at the hospital, or they can come sometimes from a funeral home that gets a body because arrangements have been made, but there's some injury to the body and they're concerned about that. So those calls get brought into the coroner's office, and either the coroner or the medical examiner, depending on the jurisdiction, will send out an investigator to investigate. And sometimes that investigation involves just getting the person's medical records. And sometimes the investigation involves talking to the family members or the people who last saw the person alive. And then that investigation gets summarized in a little sheet, which we call our daily case sheet or our daily list. And when I come in the next morning, all of the deaths from the previous 24 hours, and if it's on Monday, it's from the weekend, so we get a longer list, are summarized one by one. And then the doctors at the office make the decision of whether or not an autopsy is needed in those cases. In some cases, if it's an unexpected death in someone who has a very known documented medical history, but they just died at home instead of in the hospital, we won't necessarily do an autopsy. We might just sign out the death certificate based on the review of the medical records.
You know, I'm going to hear, of course, much more. But you know what I find interesting? You said if it occurs over the weekend, you hear it on Monday. So, you know, I had visions of these autopsies being done 24/7. Do you actually, is being a medical examiner one of the few medical specialties where it really is regular hours?
It is regular hours. It's about 9 to 5. You do get called out sometimes in the middle of the night to a scene. But in general, usually you work regular hours. That's another thing that CSI gets wrong. We're not there at 2 o'clock in the morning performing an autopsy.
Got it. Okay, so now let's get to the point where you're in the room. They call them an operating room? Is that what they call it?
Morgue.
Morgue, okay. You're in the morgue, and now you got the body bag. Now we're at that point. Walk me through the interesting mental process, the branching program, almost like a computer branching program that you use to say, okay, here are my choices first, here's what I'm going to do. Here's my choices next, what I'm going to do. Walk me through the typical decision tree.
So when the body comes in, the first thing I do is I actually pull out my worksheet. I have a little crib sheet with a body diagram on it and a checklist of all the things I need to look for. And I go up and down through the body from the head to the toes, documenting everything, hair color, eye color, scars, identifying marks, any medical or surgical procedures that have been done. And then I describe things that even looking at the fingernails, are they chipped or are they intact? Are there any tattoos that would help me identify the person? And then after I do the external examination, I will use my scalpel and my tools to take out the organs one by one and examine each organ individually, weigh it, measure it, and collect samples for things like toxicology.
I got a dumb question. Typical idiotic. I have a little live studio audience here, and I got a 13-year-old here. This is the kind of question he has. Did you ever feel like it was gross? Ooh, holding a liver? Did you vomit? Did you ever vomit? Did you, during your training? What was that really like?
That's a great question because all of medical school is a slow desensitization process from your first cadaver. When you start in medical school, you get a cadaver, and it's shocking. And you have to spend time with that cadaver getting to know the anatomy. That first autopsy that you do is not to figure out why the person died. It's just to learn anatomy. Mm-hmm. And then throughout medical school, you are working on living patients in many cases, learning how to communicate with them, mm-hmm. how to do procedures on them. So in many ways, doing an autopsy on a dead body is less emotionally stressful than it is to do it on someone who doesn't necessarily want you to do their procedures on them like a child, even though they need it in order to get better.
Desensitization is a good word. I was a medical researcher at the Rockefeller University, and the first time I did brain surgery on rats, I nearly vomited. Hmm. And then you get desensitized, and after a while, I was having chats with the assistants and whatever while I'm doing the surgery. You do get desensitized.
But every job has that.
That's right. Dear listeners, there's a takeaway there. You know, there is an initial sense of, as you screen careers, you say, ooh, I can't stand the sight of blood or whatever. And then you throw out that career as a possibility when, in fact, that is a transient thing for most people. There is a small percent of people for whom can't. But you're nodding. Are there people who really do, for whom that's a deal killer?
Well, I think that every, I always say that every job has an icky. Mm-hmm. Every job has something icky about it. Mm-hmm. And for my husband, who's a stay-at-home dad, it's changing diapers. In some cases, some of my children's diapers were way worse than some of the autopsies I had done in terms of the smell and the job itself. So you always have something that turns you off. And even among physicians, I know some doctors who will be able to deliver babies, but if they have to examine someone's foot, they don't like feet. Mm-hmm. So we all have something icky that turns us off.
There's one other takeaway that I might want to make sure my dear listeners don't miss. The checklist. There was a book written not so long ago by some Indian guy, I don't remember his name, about the power of the checklist. It is a simple tool, but it ensures you don't miss something important, and you can devote all your mental energy to what really, you know, to the decision tree, not to what's on the checklist. What's something that might surprise me on your checklist?
Well, I have a lot of acronyms, so because I don't want to write well-healed scar, I write WHS, or I have acronyms for like red abrasion is a RAB, R-A-B, or PERC, P-U-R-C is my shorthand for purple contusion.
Yeah.
So these are common acronyms I use.
Okay, let's go back to decision tree. So what are the first big decisions you have to make in terms where there's really a choice in involved, where it's not just slam dunk, this is the procedure. It's not a technician job just does the thing, but where you've got a lot of judgment. Where are the interest? Where's the first interesting judgment call you typically have to make?
The first decision tree is whether or not to perform an autopsy.
Right.
And that can change at any time. So there are cases where we'll sit at the table looking at the paperwork and decide, oh, this guy's got known heart disease and he collapsed at home. He doesn't need an autopsy. We could just sign him out as heart disease. But then we get down to the autopsy table and he's got some injury on his neck that I don't like. And he's got something wrapped around his wrist or he's got scars that indicate substance abuse in the past. I'm going to autopsy him, even though he's got heart disease, just based on the physical findings.
Okay. What's another interesting, not obvious point in the decision tree?
At the end of the autopsy, when you have all your findings and you have your list, again, we make a list of all our findings and our diagnosis, the decision about what's going to go on the death certificate, what's the cause of death. In most cases, it's pretty straightforward. But when you have someone who's got five different diseases, a heart disease, lung disease, kidney failure, and diabetes, then which one am I going to put on the death certificate?
Why does it matter?
Public health purposes. So what we put on the death certificate matters because, number one, it's an answer to the family for the what happened questions, but also all of our death certificates get filed and certified at the Department of Public Health. And those statistics affect things like funding for research into particular diseases. Mm. It affects how we're going to fund our law enforcement agencies based on whether we call things a homicide or not.
Okay, let me push on the decision tree one more time in a different way. Now I want atypical. Can you recall a hardest decision you've had to make in the course of doing an autopsy and maybe even one you got wrong?
Hardest decision.
Or a hard decision.
A hard decision. There are times where everything changes when the information changes. So, for instance, there was a case where a man died following a minor surgery, and he didn't die right away. He had a cardiac arrest after the surgery, but then he was pronounced dead 3 days later. And in doing the autopsy, there really wasn't very much in the way of findings, but it was the investigation that really elucidated what happened. It turned out that he was supposed to be monitored by nurses who were not monitoring him. Mm-hmm. The paperwork wasn't filled out. They didn't know the vital signs. Mm-hmm. Eventually, that investigation took over a year, and the nurse who was supposed to be monitoring him lost her license.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest, who I really like, her name is Judy Melnick. She is an MD, and she is a medical examiner. Her book is Working Stiff. It is a I'm going to be really honest. I always read all of my guest books except yours.
Oh, no.
Because I had read the Amazon reviews and they said it was stomach wrenching and difficult. And I have difficulty around those issues. And so this is one of those rare cases where in candor, I did not read the book, but the reviews are awesome. So I can commend it to you, at least on a crowdsourcing basis. So anyway, speaking of the crowd, hopefully there's a nice crowd of people listening to the show at this point. And I will invite you to call in with if you have a question or two for Judy Melnick about what it's really like to be a medical examiner. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before we go, the phone's lines are already ringing. But your dad committed suicide when you were young. Has that informed your work as a medical examiner?
It has. It gives me a special sensitivity for the family members of those who have died by their own hands. I know that suicide in many cases is the unspoken death. It's the one that people cover up and are afraid to talk about, that in many ways it is the silent killer, because it's just like cancer was 10 or 15 years ago, or AIDS was initially, where people were ashamed of it. And by opening up sometimes to families who are struggling with the suicidal death of a loved one, they can feel comfort in knowing that they're not the only ones out there, and that suicide survivors exist, and that we need to talk about it in order to heal and also to prevent other deaths.
There's an aspect of suicide, a statistic. Usually statistics are kind of, they're dry, they're boring, but there's a statistic that really seared itself into my brain, is that over the age of 65, the rate of men committing suicide versus women, there is 1,385% as high for men as for women. When women have a deficit, we hear about it all the time, but men have a deficit, we don't hear it at all. First of all, does that statistic surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. The one that I find most resonant of the statistics having to do with suicide is the one that challenges people's assumptions. There's this kind of common assumption that if you thwart someone from committing suicide, that they're just going to find some other way to kill themselves. And that if you take away a method, for example, you put up a barrier on a bridge, they're just going to go to another bridge and kill themselves. And that's actually not true. The statistics of suicide indicate that when we put up barriers on bridges or we thwart easy methods, the suicide rate actually does go down. And when people are thwarted or stopped from committing suicide, the majority of them will not attempt it again. It's a very low number. It's about 6 or 10% that will try again later.
I had heard that too. Very often people, while they may have thought about it a lot and had to, quote, develop the courage to do it once, really, you know, it's often done under, and you tell me if this is true, very often they're under the influence at the time before they commit suicide, and they're like at rock bottom, they got themselves very drunk, and that pushes them over the edge. How often is suicide associated with people, for, you know, separate from taking the overdose of tranquilizers or whatever? How often is, say, alcohol or pot operative?
It depends on the case. I would say that I would see drugs affecting people's behavior maybe only about half the time, if that. There are impulsive acts, and sometimes it's just the disinhibition, as we call it,
right,
of having some alcohol
right
on board, or even sometimes having antidepressants on board,
right,
because there is a phenomenon that people who are really depressed can't even get the courage up to perform suicide, but then they'll start getting antidepressants, and then they'll feel a little bit better, and that little bit better is enough to get them to complete the task.
Got it. Interesting. Okay. All our lines are lighted up. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco with Dr. Judy Melnick. What is your question or comment for her? Hello,
Hello,
it's you.
Dr. Melnick.
Hi.
Yeah. What percent of death certificates without autopsies are inaccurate or just plain wrong, and has that increased in recent years?
Good question.
That's a good question. There's actually been studies of that, that the inaccuracy rate could be anywhere from 30 to even 50%, depending on the basis for the information that was used to write the death certificate. So in many cases, when people die of natural diseases in the hospitals, the doctors are making a best guess on the medical records. When you have an autopsy, however, you're going to have a much more accurate determination.
Sure. Anyway, thank you very much for the call. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to the show. Welcome. What's your question for Judy Melnick?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I used to watch those CSI shows. I don't know why I don't anymore. I have no interest now, but their labs were always sparkling with the latest technology, and they were pretty, you know, exotic. Now, I assume that's not true, but
is it? How antiquated versus modern are the morgues?
You know, he just nailed it. That's number 7 in my 7 CSI fails on my blog post. If you Google 7 CSI fails, you'll find it. It's how can I get me that thing? If you watch the TV shows, they're all got holographic images and high tech, and we're still using sometimes technology that was discovered only 5, 10, 15 years ago. It's not the most cutting edge.
What would be, if there was one piece of equipment that you would like to have that you don't have, what would it be and what would be the case for having it?
I would like to have a CT scanner. When cases come to the hospital and have a CT scan, it definitely helps guide my investigation. And in some cases, you can use modern technology to get 3D images of the body for things like trajectory analysis to see the direction a bullet went in.
Perfect. Caller, did you have a another? I interrupted you. I'm sure you had a question.
I'm sorry. I don't know if I'm interrupting.
No, you're doing great. I was the interrupter. Go ahead. That's what talk show hosts do, but, you know, it's...
Of course, we're told to report crimes, and that's very serious in the case of sexual abuse and rape. And I think the nation was kind of shocked, and it's amazing that it's still a problem, that L.A., just to use one example, was found to have 12,000-plus untested rape kits from crimes. It's pretty scandalous and upsetting. It's like people are told to report crimes, and you mean the criminal is out there doing it more, and they have the kits, and they're not testing it. It's outrageous.
Well, the problem, you've pegged a real serious problem in the forensic sciences, is if you watch the TV shows, it makes it seem like this is such a great and sexy job and everybody wants to do it. But there's a lot of training. And in the book, Working Stiff, I talk about how laborious the training is and how many years of training go into being a forensic pathologist. Just the same thing applies for DNA analysts. There's quite a bit of schooling and training that is required to get to that position. Many of these jobs are government jobs, so they're understaffed and underpaid. And so if you were going into DNA analysis, it is more attractive to work for a private company where you'll get paid a lot more than to take a government job and take care of that backlog.
I want to thank you very much for the call. Before we go back to the phones, you talked about training. One of my number one pet peeve in the area of career is how terrible the training generally is. Ironically, the more prestigious the institution, the more theoretical and unapplied it is. You went to UCLA Medical School. To what extent do you believe that your training at UCLA Medical School prepared you to be a medical examiner?
It did, because you need the basis in the sciences in order to do the job at the medical examiner's office. So you can't just go and figure out how someone died when the death is sudden, unexpected, and the person has no medical history if you haven't already had a basic sciences training and a basic pathology training in doing autopsies in patients that have medical history. So that's the starting point. The starting point is hospital autopsies in patients with known diseases. And only then can you go and take the patients who we don't know anything about.
My question would be, I mean, I know we've got 4 years of medical school. You had an internship. You probably had some residency as well?
Correct. So it's 4 years of medical school. Then I did a total of 5 years of pathology training. So that included a post-sophomore fellowship, which I did in medical school, and residency training in both anatomic and clinical pathology.
Right. So that's my question. It is 9 years and $200,000 or $300,000 of cost, and the amount of medical knowledge that at least many, well, my lawyer clients, my doctor clients, my engineer clients, they say it really is wildly too long relative to the amount of useful information and even just thinking skills that get derived. Do you think that's too harsh, or do you agree with that?
I think the training for forensic pathology needs to be this long. I just think that forensic pathologists need to be compensated in some way for all the debt they're incurring, because really, right now in our country, the biggest problem approaching students who want to commit themselves to this field is they're getting out of medical school, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars
exactly.
in debt.
Yeah.
And so their career choices are going to be limited by what they can pay off that debt. And a government job is a lot less attractive.
Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Dr. Judy Melnick, the author of Working Stiff, 2 years, 262 bodies in the making of a medical examiner. What is your question or comment for her? Hi, it's you. Hello.
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, hi. I'm calling for my daughter. She's 14 years old, and she's very, very interested in this field. And I've explained to her the process of going through medical school. And I'm hoping that she will find other ways to get into this field without having to go through all of that training. Can you talk about that? And also, she wants to know, after medical school, how does she get her first job?
Right. So how? Right. Because the especially we are likely headed towards single payer health care in this country, and so if compensation will actually likely decline for doctors, the length of training will be long. Are there there's a term called deaner that I had heard of for people who are kind of assistants in the morgue. What are some shortcut routes to nonetheless meaningful employment in your general field?
So one route is to go the law enforcement route. If you're working in a coroner's jurisdiction, the sheriff's department tends to, depends on the location of where you work or live, the sheriff's department may run the coroner's office, in which case you could go through law enforcement and train as a sheriff's deputy. And if you show interest in working at the coroner's office, they will be more than happy to train you on the job for that. There are autopsy technicians, so you can be a physician's assistant or go through technical training to learn how to assist in performing an autopsy. Mm-hmm. The pay is less than that of a physician, but again, the training is going to be shorter.
A lot shorter, I would guess, yeah.
And then there are also people who work as administrators in our office in terms of filing paperwork or working as grief counselors to help the bereaved. So there are lots of different ways to work in a medical examiner coroner's office.
Caller, the two she mentioned in passing, physician assistant, that's one of my very favorite careers. It seems to represent almost the, especially as we project forward and with eventually everybody in America going to be covered, ever more of the direct patient care is going to be done by physician assistants, and the training is much shorter. And yet you get to do about 80% of what doctors do. You do initial diagnosis, treatment, patient education, etc. And so if you're looking for an alternative, your daughter's looking for an alternative that doesn't require $300,000 in debt and more than a decade of post college training, for me, that's a real smart choice. So anyway, thank you very much for calling. Let's take one more call, and then I have some more questions for you, and then I'll let you go. Okay, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Dr. Judy Melnick. What's your question or comment for her? Hello, it's you. Hi.
Is this me?
Yes.
Okay, this is Klaus. I'm calling from Berkeley, and as always, a very interesting show.
Thank you.
Incidentally, all the reports that the doctor is writing are bound by my shop, and I'm only calling because I'm at the moment working on necropsy reports and register pages that she's probably worked on, and so that's my 3 cents.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's talking about the binding of the reports. I want to comment on the fact that all our reports are public record. So because the deaths are sudden and unexpected and violent, there is a public need to know about potential dangers and safety hazards. And that's why when someone dies, whether it's your neighbor or your cousin or your parent, anybody can have access to that autopsy report. They can't necessarily have access to the photos. The photos are protected, but the report itself is public record, which is why the press can get it as well.
Earlier you talked about one of the first things you do when you've got a patient there is you look for identifying marks and things. You were at 9/11 and you did a number of autopsies, and I imagine that some, am I correct, some were burned beyond recognition, and your main job was to try to get, you knew the cause of death, but it was to get to ID the patient. Is that correct?
Correct. So 9/11 was different from routine autopsies, right, not only because of the forces involved, but also because our mission was somewhat different. Instead of focusing on the cause and the manner of death, which we do on routine cases, in this case, we knew that the cause was going to be multiple blunt traumatic injuries. We knew that the manner, it was a homicide, but really what we wanted to do is identify the deceased individual so that their body could be returned to their family.
So, no, when you think about identification of charred remains, you think about dental records and things like that, but how would you, I imagine you use that and other things, how would you then hook up somebody, you find somebody's dental records or whatever, or some remaining of their fingerprint, and how would you then tie that to an individual?
So our job at the medical examiner's office was to identify the physical findings and document them, and we're collecting data. So that would include things like fingerprints, sometimes even jewelry on the body if it was inscribed or unique would get described in order to help at least with a preliminary identification. And then ultimately we need a scientific modality, something like X-ray or DNA analysis, in order to make a match. But you have to make a match to a living person or to a known sample from that person.
Right.
So in the case of, for example, dental X-rays or other skeletal X-rays, the family members of the deceased were asked to provide the medical records and the X-rays so that we would have what's called an exemplar for comparison, and the same thing for DNA.
Makes perfect sense. You know, obviously a conversation about the work of a medical examiner, coroner, or whatever is it's largely about sadness. But are there happy moments in your work?
The happy moments in my work come from the closure I can give to families. So it's, even though we start from sadness, there are a lot of families that I've spoken to over the years, and really it does take years between when a death occurs and when the criminal case is prosecuted or when civil litigation ends. Sometimes it takes several years, and I'm communicating with the family. Mm-hmm. So I will get birthday cards. I will get birth announcements when I've had several cases where the family has lost a child and I've done the autopsy and given them closure. And then they remember me a year later, 2 years later, when they have a child, and they send me a birth announcement. Mm. So I know that I've played some role in helping them heal.
You know, Judy, I listen and watch your demeanor. You do not seem to be a sad person. You seem to be an upbeat person. And they say that after you're over a certain age, you wear your personality on your face. You look like an upbeat, happy person. To what extent, I would imagine that I'm just going to make a little side note. My mother just recently died a couple months ago, and she had her typical slow, yucky end. She was also a Holocaust survivor. So she had as much environmental crap happen to her as most people, but she was preternaturally upbeat and pleasant. Here you are in a career of death, and you seem preternaturally upbeat. How much of who you are is really just who you are in spite of the fact that you spend your life around death so much?
I think it also changes you to some degree, though, because when you see the worst every single day, you value life so much more. Mm. You hug your kids closer. Mm. You spend more time with your husband. Mm. You really value the things that really matter, because it could end at any time. And so I think that in many cases, my work with death does make me value life even more.
Okay. Last question. There's tons of obvious advice given about, how to succeed in a career. Work hard, make connections and all that crap. Is there a piece of non-obvious advice that you'd want to give to someone who is an aspiring, like that previous caller's, child? Some non-obvious advice about either a career in medicine broadly or specifically, somebody who aspired to a career as a medical examiner?
Well, the obvious advice, as you said, is work hard and study your science and your math and your STEM materials. But the less obvious thing is that ultimately a work in this field is one within the realm of law enforcement. So you have to have a clean record. You can't get yourself arrested. You can't get involved with drugs or
even
substance
marijuana.
Abuse.
Let's say you smoke marijuana. You can't be a medical examiner if you smoke pot?
It's not so much the smoking pot. It's the getting caught and getting arrested that's the problem, because all of these jobs involve background checks. Mm. And ultimately, if you're a regular marijuana user, there's going to be a temptation when you work on the job and you have marijuana on a body to take it for your own use. Mm. Or that's where people assume that you're going to have the temptation, whether it's true or not. So ultimately, you have to have a clean record. You can't have any skeletons in your closet.
So to speak.
All of the jobs have background checks. It's really important to stay clean.
Well, you have been more than clean here on this show. You were a great guest, as I said earlier. Judy Melnick is she's a consultant, a forensic consultant. And a couple of things I want to tell you. Her book is, again, Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, Making of a Medical Examiner. And she is going to appear live and in person, not dead, live, absolutely live, at Barnes & Noble in Corte Madera today at 5 p.m. and at one of my very favorite bookstores, Book Passage in Marin, Corte Madera, on the 27th at 7 p.m. You will find her delightful, I promise. And thank you so much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco, Judy.
I appreciate it. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, and now, my dear listeners, the attention turns to you. If you are stuck in any aspect of your career and you could use a little free advice, that's what you get around here. I call them workovers, but I promise not to pummel you. The phone number for the 16 or 76 self-employed, unemployed employed, government employed, private sector, small business, large business, whatever your problem is, I usually can at least help you get a baby step, take a baby step forward. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for that workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I keep track, I keep a list of all of the little ideas that enter my little brain that I might want to share with you. And I thought while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, I would share a couple. You know, we make fun. I'm looking at Judy's husband, who's a Harvard graduate, and now it's a stay-at-home husband. And, you know, we see the statistics that graduates of Harvard and Stanford, you know, a very high percentage of them go into what we would disparagingly call soulless professions. They go into investment banking. They go into management consulting for the big bucks. And we say, how could they do that? There's so much injustice in the world. They really should be working for nonprofits or activism or whatever. Well, sometimes I can understand that, but I always like to present the other side. It is so hard to, quote, make a difference. So hard working, you know, I watch the Ferguson thing and they talk about what are the real root causes and poverty and education and underrepresented minorities in the police force. I'm old now, I'm 64, and I've been hearing this since I was 14. And the problems remain, if anything, as large or larger than they've ever been. So can we really so blithely criticize a Harvard or Stanford graduate for saying, you know, it ain't so easy to, quote, make a difference. I can slam dunk make $200,000, $300,000, $1 million partners at the McKinsey's and places like that make $1 million. Can we really be so condescending as to imply that they are foolish or short-sighted in not working as public interest lawyers or activists for prison reform or whatever? So that was my musing on that. And now let's go to the phones. I'll give out the phone number again. If you or someone you love has got a work-life problem, the phone number here for what I call a workover, 415-841-4134. What's that the number for? Let's work with Marty Nemko's call in line, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
I'm just wondering, I was a lead for the group for 4 years that I work at, and I'm just exhausted. I have to attend, I think, something like 15-minute meetings a week.
Wow, I hate that.
Doing a number of things. And so I'm having a meeting with my manager. I've already mentioned a little bit of this to her, but I don't think she's to really pay attention. And what I need to get across is it's not that I don't want to work hard, and it's not that I don't want to be part of the group or leave the company or anything, but I really need to just step down from the lead. And there's already somebody who's very interested, who does a good job, who's already doing some of the things. But I don't want her to feel that, you know, I'm sort of putting her away or not glad that she made me lead or anything. I don't know quite how to say that.
First of all, you should be so proud of yourself. American society is based on the principle that up is the only way. And indeed, not everybody is meant to be a chief. There is a tremendous need for Indians. And the sense of self-knowledge that helps you realize that helps you defy the societal conventional wisdom and realize that your best contribution to the world and to yourself and your family is to be an Indian, not a chief, is much to your credit. And I think that if you frame it in those terms and say, you know what, I want to do that, I'm grateful. You did very well. So just saying I'm grateful for the opportunity to have been a lead. But, you know, I'm well aware of the Peter principle, rising to your level of incompetence, and I don't want to do that. I want to do what I do best. And what I do best is being an individual contributor. And what do you think, Mr. or Ms. Boss? I mean, you're a hero. That's fantastic. I think this is the easiest call I've had in weeks. Am I right? I mean, are you not in perfect shape here?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And emphasize that, you know, I still will work hard because I'm taking over some
right.
of the work from the other person as well. So just to say, but I don't want to say I'm so tired because I don't want to get that you know, make her feel that way. But yeah, I guess that's a good way to do it, just to say, I feel that individual contributor is what I want to do right now with my life. So.
I probably wouldn't couch it in terms of the fatigue. There's no need to mention the fatigue angle. I think you just talk about where is the best fit, where can you make the best contribution, and, you know, that's fine. And also, you know, frankly, Judy, my guest, wrote the word mentor down here. And to what extent do you think that in your role, even if you're an individual contributor, you may be able to be a mentor to one or more of your other coworkers, having been in the driver's seat for a while? What do you think about that?
That's an excellent point. Yeah.
There you go. Judy should take over my show. Anyway, well, thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
Okay. The phone number again, if you would like a 3-minute workover, sometimes it's 5, sometimes it's 1. Anyway, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for some career help. The price is certainly right. 0 zippo nada. The phone number 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I came across a statistic that shocked me. When I hear the word railroad, I think of like 19th century, you know, steam engines and whatever. Did you know that this year, in the last 12 months at least, freight railroads, you know, like the Burlington Northern or Santa Fe, whatever they're called, they hired, guess how many people? 11,000. There's an under-the-radar career I always like. You know, everybody knows my doctor and lawyer and nurse, even physician assistant these days. But not too many people think about a career in the railroads. And I really do believe that, you know, if you're a star, you know, if you did go to Harvard and you're great, you can pretty much choose your field. Oh, yes, I love the environment. I'm going to work in the environment. But if you're a more average person, we're not allowed to use words like average, but it's true. By definition, you know, most 50% of people are below average, right? And so, you know, one of the ways in which you can survive in a job market that continues despite the official low unemployment rate, but so many of the jobs are crappy, part-time, temp, in a world of where with so many college graduates now, the highest percentage in history, to survive in that, and one more statistic that just scares the hell out of me, The Atlantic reported that 53.6% of all college graduates under 25 are working on jobs that they could have done straight out of high school, like barista, or unemployed altogether. So my job is to give you an edge ethically, and the way I can give you an edge ethically is getting you to consider under-the-radar careers like in the freight railroad industry. So, and while I'm on that, I guess let me share a couple of others that are like that. Let's see. There are so many of my clients live for sports. Sports, 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 sports. And so they say, you know, they want to work for the Giants and they want to work for the A's or whatever, the 49ers. But there is a whole field called sports information directing, which is at every college, small and large, as well as the pros. It's really impossible to get a job, so that's not under the radar at all. But take a little college like College of Notre Dame. I'm not talking about Notre Dame in South Bend. I'm talking about this little college here, College of Notre Dame. Or, you know, Dominican College or whatever. They have got sports teams, and they've got somebody who is packaging the information to give to the media, to the alumni, who they want more money from. There's an under-the-radar career you might want to think about. Another under-the-radar career, one of the things that I do that's in my career coaching role is I do a lot of succession planning because I myself am getting older. I tend to have a lot of older clients, and many of them are executives, nonprofit sector, for-profit sector, or their own business, and they realize that they're not going to want to be doing this when they're 75. So if they're 60 or 65 or 70, they're saying, okay, I need to go and figure out how to develop a plan to have somebody replace me and leave a legacy. That's psychologically very difficult, practically difficult, but there is a wonderful little niche, succession planning. As the boomers are all aging, that is going to capitalize on demographics. But nobody's ever grown up saying, oh, I want to be a succession planning consultant, under the radar. In the end, you don't need to be a genius. You need to be somebody who is emotionally sensitive, who knows a little bit about hiring practices, who knows a little bit about can learn well and quickly enough to learn enough about their business to help be a good advisor. great little under-the-radar career. One more time, I'll give out the phone number, and then we're going to go to the phones. If you, this is a great time to call. Usually the lines are all full. God knows why. Maybe I suck today. In any case, this is a good time to call. The phone number here, if you'd like a three-minute workover here, any kind of career problem for you or someone you love, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. To the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to explore a little bit more the comment you made at the beginning, which was that, you know, you understood, given the lack of progress that you perceive, that people would turn to finance who had advanced degrees or, you know, some sort of more lucrative field than going into public interest law. I know from what you said that your daughter graduated from law school and she's probably not doing public interest law.
She is. She absolutely is. She works for the U.S. Department of Justice.
Oh, okay.
But she's a Yale Law School graduate. She was Hillary Clinton's personal assistant.
Okay.
She
I
was a superstar.
Talk about your daughter. Yeah. I don't want to talk about your daughter.
Okay.
I don't about her. I just
But I wanted to point out that you know, that it's not, it is very difficult to even get to do public interest law. And the reason I mentioned my daughter is because she wanted to work for NARAL.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about her, Marty. I really don't.
Well, this isn't your show. I'm allowed to make comments, even if it's not precisely what you'd like to talk about. Did you have do you have a comment you wanted to make after I finished my comment? No. Let's go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air.
Hi, Marty. This is Ari.
Hi, Ari.
Hi. So my question is about, skirts the ethical issue, and I wanted to ask you, I can guess what your take is, but I'm going to ask anyway. In New York, I live in California now, of course, but when I lived in New York, I had a friend who said he was in a master's. He had just finished he was in a master's course, but he applied for jobs as though he had finished his master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a job as an executive, and what happened was he worked at this position as an executive, and then they gave him a promotion, at which point they researched his references and found out he had lied, and they fired him.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, he had enough experience that he got another job as an executive, and he just continued, you know, his career march upwards. And I wanted to know, what's your take on people who I just say questionable stuff on their resume or as a reference or that kind of thing.
I guess, you know, and it's very hard to put myself in the shoes of somebody who is desperate or whatever. And so it's easy for me to be sanctimonious, but I have to be. I honestly think that while it is true that many people could do the job, I remember I think about the book Catch Me If You Can by Frank Abagnale, whatever, where he ended up doing a good job apparently as a doctor in a hospital with never having gone to medical school. I'm aware that, and as I said earlier, that training in the universities is often not very good, and in certain fields you can get away with it. I, from the 30,000-foot level, am profoundly concerned about our American society that is becoming ever less ethical. I read the statistics on the large percentage of people who do cheat on their resumes, interviews, cover letters, phony references, all the rest of it. And I think a society that is not based on integrity is doomed to failure. And so one can easily rationalize an individual decision to say, well, I was really great anyway and whatever. I just can't, at least from where I sit, justify it from a large societal perspective. I like to think that if he was as efficacious as he is, even if they generally strongly prefer a master's degree, he could have shown that efficacy through his previous work, through his cover letters, through his interviews. And very often, even though employers say they want a master's degree or whatever, when they see somebody who's exceptional, they often make mistakes. They often make exceptions and hire the person. So I have to take the ethical high road on this one. Anyway, what's your reaction?
I have a follow up, which I appreciate your honesty with that. Do you think that it's a common practice in the United States?
It is.
Because I know in Europe,
it is.
I had to apply for jobs, and they wanted like
proof of everything. Mm. Whereas here, you just write it on paper, and nobody really seems to follow up.
No, they do follow. You know, there's whole industry of background checkers now that absolutely do verify all that stuff, especially for important positions. But of course, there's still many employers who still are naive and believe that it's that people are relatively truthful. I do believe that it's probably in this day and age, especially when it's so hard to get a good job, that employers, if you know, it behooves them to do to do some verification of that stuff. And especially like in interviews, in recommendations, there are so many phony recommendations where they use their girlfriend to say that the girlfriend was their boss, that it really does behoove the employer to go beyond listed references. Listed references are too often dishonest. And so finally, if the person lists a certain workplace as his previous workplace, the right thing to do is to call that previous workplace, ask to speak to who the person's direct boss was. And I know that sometimes official policy is we're not allowed to give references, but you can tell a ton from tone of voice. So if
let me finish. Oftentimes, we'll just verify employment.
I understand that. What I'm now trying to give a little value added to my listeners who might be in a position of having to verify employment for somebody, and I would encourage them to speak to the boss, and even if and say, I'm hiring for a very important position here. John Jones has applied. This is what the position is like. Are you in a position to tell me if this person was great or not? And even if they say, you know, oh, I'm sorry, we're not allowed to give references. I really wish I could. That says one thing. Oh, yes, he worked here, and I am not allowed to give you references. Just the tone of voice can tell you a lot. So I really do think employers need to follow up not just with the references that are listed. Now, what were you going to say?
No, that was it. I heard that they can – a lot of places, like places I've worked where I've done exceptionally – I know that they will not say anything other than verify my employment.
Right.
Even though I may have a manager or something who will give me a very high evaluation, it's still against corporate policy for them to do that. But, I don't know. I did some volunteer work for a video game developer, and I was just talking to a recruiter, and they completely won't want to consider my resume because I don't have anything on there that's video game related. And so I'm thinking I could switch this volunteer time around to look like I was working for the guy. And it's not that much of a reach.
You don't have to say whether it's paid or not. You can certainly put on your resume that you did the work. Nowhere does it say that it has to be paid or not. You can say work experience. It doesn't have to be paid work experience. You can be completely honest and say, here was my experience. Here's what I did. There's no problem there.
Yeah, okay, I understand what you're saying,
Yep. Anyway, I thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you.
You know, the answer really ultimately is this whole process by which we apply for jobs is completely so susceptible to BS. We need to replace the resume, the cover letter, the interview, and the reference with what is infinitely more valid, and that is the simulation. There need to be online simulations produced, simple ones, produced by the employer that all candidates would have to. They're simulations of hard tasks that were needed to be done on the job. And then, of course, there can be cheating on that, but the applicants are told, this is a screen, and if you pass, then we're going to ask you to do a similar test under proctored conditions. That way, the employer doesn't have to be incurring the cost of having hundreds of applicants do it. That is both much more valid, and you know, we live in a world where race and gender and sexual orientation are primary. If you watch the news, you read the New York Times or whatever, that is the issue. There is no better way to avoid racial, gender, or sexual orientation, or ageism prejudice, than by having those really work related job tasks as the criterion, as the core criterion for employment. Anyway, that is all the time we have for Work with Marty Nemko today. I want to thank you for all listening and calling in, and Judy Melnick for being my guest. Again, her book is Working Stiff. It's about being a medical examiner. Fascinating, apparently stomach-wrenching. She will be today. You can meet her at Barnes & Noble in Corte Madera at 5 o'clock, or in about 10 days from now on the 27th at Book Passage in Corte Madera. And I also want to tell you about next week. I rarely do this. I rarely have another career counselor on, but I thought it'd be important to kick around the thorny issues of being a career counselor with some other, you know, some really good career counselors. I'm talking with a guy named Adrian Klapak, who's got amazing Yelp reviews. And so in any case, until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.